Sutta, you also mentioned the subtle obstacle is contemplating Dhamma. Is that, did I get it right?
Yeah. Even contemplating Dhamma can be a subtle obstacle. Yeah. Yeah. The Buddha would encourage us use it as necessary. You know, sometimes our mind might be stuck on something really crude. You know, maybe we're thinking of sensual thoughts, or maybe we're stuck in hatred, or, you know, there's something even worse, something more crude. Okay, well, we can use investigation of Dhamma to loosen up that attachment. But having loosened those more crude attachments, just because someone investigates the Dhamma, that's still not as good as, let's say, a jhana or the Brahmaviharas. Yeah, so it's kind of a stepping stone. Investigating the Dhamma is kind of a stepping stone to going deeper in meditation. There's a simile. Most of you probably heard this simile of the raft, where the Buddhist teachings are like a raft, and you paddle with your arms and legs to cross this water to get to the other shore. And the other shore, that's like Nibbana, okay? That's the more popular simile of the raft. Now, there's a second simile of the raft, not so popular. And in this simile, same thing, you have a raft, you paddle with your arms and legs, you get to the other shore. That's like Nibbana. Or it could just be like the deathless at all, any kind of, any super mundane state. It could just be the Brahmaviharas, okay? Any kind of peace of heart, that could be seen as the farther shore as well, okay? Now, in that state, so you are standing on the far shore of the deathless. Maybe you're not an arahant yet, but at least you are in touch with this deathless element, okay? Now, in that state, the Buddha says, does it make sense to lift the raft out of the water and walk around carrying the raft on your head? No, it doesn't make sense. Of course, you wouldn't carry around the raft. Once you cross to the other shore, you abandon the raft because it's done its job. Okay, so in that same way, once you cross to the other shore, you abandon even investigating the Dhamma. Okay, so the Dhamma is just a raft to get you to the deathless. But once you achieve the deathless, set aside your investigating. Yeah, so... There are a lot of Ananda-like monks, you know, scholarly monks, and they really want to encourage study of the Dhamma. And I say, awesome. Monks should do that. That encouragement is good. But there is such a thing as too much study, okay? And here's the case where we can say there's too much study. It's like, if you break through the deathless, set aside investigating the Dhamma. Okay, so insofar as you can stay in that deathless state, you know, see what you can do to just stay in that state. Now, maybe later on, you know, maybe, I don't know, an hour later, 2 hours later, the next day or whatever, maybe you lose that deathless state again. You're kind of back to normal, you know, normal. Like, no jhanas, no Brahmaviharas, just kind of flat, you know. Okay, maybe you should do a little more investigating of Dhamma. What did I do? What did I do to cause that? Could I do it again, you know? Some sort of investigating. You know, what am I stuck on here? Do I have some kind of a wrong view? You know what I mean? This kind of investigating maybe can get you back there again, back in the breaking through the Brahmaviharas or whatever. So, and then, okay, abandon the Dhamma again, investigating it once you are standing on that far shore of the deathless. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So even the teachings of the Buddha are just a means to an end. Okay? They're a means to an end, which is Nibbana. And that's a subtle distinction. This is in contrast to those who would hold up the Dhamma as some like absolute and supreme thing, and there's nothing higher than it. And I would say, well, no, it's just a means to an end. It's just a means to an end. Yes, it's sacred. Yes, it's awesome, but There is something even higher, and that's Nibbana. Or just the deathless. Any deathless, any Brahmavihara, any jhana is above it. Any other questions?
Okay. Oh. I was mentioned about the Brahmavihara, the state of Brahmavihara. What I'd like to know is how does it compare to jhana in terms of the degree of maybe happiness or calm? Is there a sort of measurement that we will know what stage we are in?
Okay, the question is, how would we know the difference between a Brahmavihara and a jhana? A Brahmavihara is something you could have while walking or doing some other activity. It's kind of like a heavenly, floaty feel. It's kind of like a euphoric feeling. It's very... like, you'll say to yourself, ah, so this is what the angels would, you know, feel like, or what the devas would feel like. It's very, it's blissful, but it's not, like, overpoweringly blissful. Okay, you can still function. You can still, you know, potentially do other activities. Jhanas, not so, okay? You can't be in a jhana and also talk to somebody. You can't be in a jhana and also be walking. You will need to be sitting still, and it is very overpowering. Like, it just totally blots out your mind. Like, there is no... maybe in the first jhana, there's a bit of thinking which is threatening to ruin your jhana, but you manage to keep coming back to the object of meditation in the first jhana. But it's... Anyway, the bliss is very strong. So it's not just this floaty... you know, angels floating in the sky. It's like a blast, and the blast blows you away. Okay? Like, there's no you anymore, because that blast blows you away. Okay? You have no sense of self. There's just this utter blast of bliss, and you are blown away. It's very strong. It's like, when the experience is over, you'll look back and you'll wonder, like, it doesn't really get stronger than that. That was as much bliss as I could pretty much handle. Yeah.
I believe you mentioned that for the jhana, when you attain jhana, there's some physical indication, like a flutter below the belly button, that kind of thing.
That's not in the suttas anywhere.
Yeah.
And I don't say everyone would experience that. Some practitioners will note this experience. And it's a subtle thing. This fluttering thing is just subtle. It's very minor. It's next to nothing compared to the power of the jhana.
Is there any indication for Brahmavihara, the physical sensation?
No. Not to my mind, no. Yeah. Now it has a very comprehensive feeling, but as to some sign or indication, like a fluttering or something, no.
Ajahn, does that mean that the Brahmaviharas doesn't really have any meaning of indication, just the feeling itself?
Well, you feel it. You definitely feel it, you know? Like, if I threw you out of an airplane and you were falling through the sky, would you feel it? Or would you be like, I don't feel anything? No, you would feel something, okay? So there is a nimitta there. Yeah. So it's, you know, the more I try to give you clear, unconfusable descriptive language, it's not possible. There will always be a way in which my words are not clear enough for you.
Sorry?
Probably not. Yeah, so earlier in the retreat, I recommended this four elements meditation thing, you know, earth, air, fire, water. Now, and spend maybe like 30-ish seconds on each one. Now, that one is suitable when the mind is very kind of unsettled and very uncooperative. You know, the mind's just very, very stuck on thoughts. And hey, that's normal. When you, you know, you just came from KL or whatever, Seremban or Malacca here, you know, it's normal. You know, a layperson's life, yes, is a busy life. There's stress, there's, you know, it is totally normal to come to the monastery, to come to your retreat, and, you know, there's all this momentum still from the lay life. It takes at least the first 3 days for that to start settling down. Yeah, so this four elements thing can be useful, you know, when the mind really doesn't want to settle down. But I would warn you, you probably won't get into a jhana with it, because it is too, you could say, unsettled. It's too, it keeps changing, you know. Yeah. Just like I was saying earlier, how, like, if we have a more gurus attachment, a more, you know, big attachment to, like, sensuality or hatred or something, and then we investigate the Dhamma, that's more subtle. But then we even have to let go of the Dhamma as we go into a deeper jhana. You know, so it's like a gearing down into more subtlety, into more steadiness and more stability, more stillness. Yeah, so that four elements thing is just, it's just to settle you down. It just gears you down. Yeah, but to enter a jhana, most people are going to be doing mindfulness of body or mindfulness of breath, or perhaps the both of them. And the breath will probably slow down and get very fine and subtle as well. The breath will slow down. Some people would go so far as to say, in the fourth jhana, the breath stops. Now, I wouldn't personally go so far as to say the breath must stop in the fourth jhana. I would say the breath might stop in the fourth jhana, or just get very subtle. I don't see it as being like a prerequisite to the fourth jhana. It is not certainly the case. It is just often the case that the breath will, like, it gets so subtle, it is as though it stops in the fourth jhana. Yeah, so in order to enter a jhana, one will need some kind of object of meditation which is stable, steady, unchanging. You know, don't be changing up your technique. Even this scanning thing, this scanning the body from head to toe, you probably won't enter a jhana doing that. But I say it is a good, it's a good way to discover the areas of your body that you have no feeling, okay, where it's numb, it's blank, you can't feel it, and one can restore the sensitivity and restore the feeling, and that becomes part of having an awareness of the whole body at once. Eventually this kind of ripens up to being a whole body awareness, a whole body awareness. Might take you a while, you know, be patient, but there does come a time you can feel the whole thing at once, the whole thing. And that, you know, that wholeness and steadiness can then go into a jhana, I say.
I think that a few days ago I heard you mention that for you personally, on certain days you will choose object of meditation that probably works better on that day. And one of the objects you mentioned was composure.
Composure.
How do you use composure as an object of meditation? And can you get jhana with that?
Composure?
Yes.
I don't think I said that.
I'm so sorry. Compassion.
Compassion.
Compassion, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say compassion and jhana are the same thing. With compassion, there is a sense of like it's compassion towards somebody or towards a group of people. And it can be quite impersonal, but it sort of has this flavor to it of like, may we all be at peace, even though I know what we've done, even though I know that we aren't perfect. And there is sort of this regard for others, even if it's an impersonal one. And now, it could be a stepping stone which leads to the jhanas later. A Brahmavihara can be kind of a stepping stone to a jhana, sure. It's like a more, just like these suttas I read where, you know, the gold is repeatedly rinsed and it gets deeper and deeper into refinement. Same thing. So compassion might be a step towards deeper refinement.
The reason I'm asking is because I think in the retreat I went to 2 years ago, the teacher asked me to use compassion as an object of meditation to as I asked about the issue of some chronic pains that I'm experiencing, any better meditation can help or not. And she actually says, try compassion. Meditating on the compassion.
Okay.
Does it work?
Well, would it relieve pain? I have a hard time believing that that would relieve the pain. I don't see that anywhere in the suttas. But maybe if one is feeling very frustrated about one's past, you know, shortcomings, you know, one feels perhaps, you know, one feels that one is not good enough, perhaps, or one isn't kind of like, I don't know, meritorious enough or talented enough or skilled enough or whatever. Compassion can be good for directed towards oneself. Compassion like, may I be at peace anyway, even though I know I'm not perfect. Okay, so maybe I'm not perfect. I have these pains. I have these, like I have arthritis in my knees, or maybe I'm, you know, have this or that defilement still, but I'll have compassion towards myself, even though I am not perfect. So I would say compassion can help with that. It can help if one has not enough like self-esteem or self, you know, I don't know, maybe self-respect or self forgiveness around mistakes. Yeah.
How do you normally practice sensory restraint, and do you do contemplation on the drawbacks of sexuality?
Well, how do we do sense restraint? That would be a good one. Yeah. Yeah, see the drawbacks of sensuality. Yeah, anything like that. Okay, well, maybe this is enough for now.